It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's very likely that you or a loved one have experienced mental illness or will in the future. That's why this is an important hour for you to take in, the extent of suffering due to mental illness in our state, in our country, and to take in the wanting state of our mental health care system. One in five adults, that's about 40 million Americans, experience mental illness each year. And many people with a serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or severe depression, find insufficient care for their conditions. In his new book, my guest, Dr. Ken Rosenberg, addresses the historical, political, and economic forces that have resulted in what has been called the greatest social crisis of the 21st century. It's the result of a seven-year inquiry into the lives of Americans with serious mental illness. He also writes about the struggles with having a sister who suffered from schizophrenia. Rosenberg's book is titled Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. Dr. Ken Rosenberg joins us for the hour. Dr. Rosenberg, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I want to reach out to our listeners this hour to have you join in. Dr. Rosenberg will be talking about his sister and the horrible struggles she encountered, his family encountered in trying to get her help. We'd like to have you join us with your experience of a loved one or perhaps yourself been touched by severe mental illness. What was the experience of care like? Did you find it insufficient or was it sufficient? Tell us the experience. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Dr. Rosenberg, I wanted to have you tell us about Merle in a moment, but before that, expand a little bit on the state of mental health care in this country and why you wrote this book.
Well, I wrote the book, frankly, because as a psychiatrist, clinical psychiatrist, I'm actually an addiction psychiatrist specializing in addiction in Manhattan, I truly felt it's the most important thing I could be doing with my life. I felt that the problems of those with serious mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, suicidal depression, are really neglected. In fact, I think it's fair to say that as a profession, psychiatry, and as a country, the United States, we have abandoned our sickest, our neediest patients. And I thought that really has to change. First of all, people need to be aware of it, because first, foremost, and at the end of the day, what we all need is to have a conversation. But you can't change something you don't talk about. So that's why I wrote the book. That's why I wrote about my personal experiences. Had no intention, honestly, about writing about my own family. But I thought, you know, I really need to do that, because I need the reader to understand why the heck I was writing this, and that this is not just a professional interest, but this is a personal interest as well.
Mm-hmm. And I should mention here that your efforts went into making a film on this of the same name. You are a Peabody Award-winning documentary filmmaker. Bedlam is the title of the film. You're a producer and director of it. It's playing in the U.S. documentary competition at the 2019 Sundance Film Festival.
Yes, it was in Sundance, and it will be on PBS's Independent Lens April 13th, 2020, and it'll be available before that, but really for the mass audience, it'll be shown on PBS in April 2020.
Okay. Let's start where you start the book, Dr. Rosenberg, by telling us about your sister, Merle, and how the system failed her. She's no longer alive. Tell us a little bit about what Merle was like as a child. You capture that so well in your book.
Thank you. I mean, first and foremost, Merle was my best friend and a very loving sister. Had a great smile, had a great laugh, had a great heart in every way, shape, and form. Merle also had anxieties, and she had depressions, and she was moody, and it was hard for her to make friends. And she had challenges that my other sister and I did not have in school. And those, I think, you know, in hindsight, were largely to her anxiety and depression and the struggles that she had. Like many people, when they get into who are vulnerable and who develop a serious mental illness, those struggles morph from angst to psychosis. That rarely happens, but 4 to 5% of us will develop a serious mental illness at some point in our life, like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. And that's precisely what happened to Merle when she was 18, 20, the age when this hits. there are scientific and interesting reasons for that, but that's just the facts. So I was 14 years old when she was 20, 21. She was institutionalized. I decided then and there I wanted to become a psychiatrist because I love my sister so dearly and wanted to do everything I could to kind of, if not help her, help people like her and help families like her. As it turned out, I became an addiction psychiatrist, which had very little to do with Meryl, but had to do with people with serious illness. But that's also pertinent because in psychiatry in the 20th century, the vast number of psychiatrists did not treat people with serious mental illness. And that's still true. We abdicate or relegate the treatment of those who are sickest to those with the least training because of the insurance model, because of the private care pay model. Particularly in this country, those people with the serious, most serious illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, generally speaking, get treated by the people who are newest on the block, the freshest faces, the interns, the young residents. It's not a specialty. It's not something that people aspire to, you know, a field that they aspire to work in. There are some people, and there are quite a few dedicated people, but that's not the majority of the profession, particularly in the last century. And I think it's fair to say in this century, where, you know, among the reasons for writing the book is to change that, to make psychiatrists realize that, you know, this is an interesting and important, if not the most important area of medicine to address our attention to.
Mm-hmm. Take us back to those teenage years you remember of your daughter, Merle, and how in terms of that teenage behavior morphed into an adult psychosis. What were the behaviors that you increasingly saw in your sister?
Well, you know, the early, what we call prodrome part of these serious mental illnesses are very insidious, and the vast majority of them never become serious mental illnesses. But for Meryl, it was social withdrawal. It was difficulty getting along with others. It was, you know, a really bad temper that could explode. And, you know, all kids explode, all people explode, but she would explode particularly in a combustible way and get in fights with my parents, my father. My father was this incredibly kind, yet also really strong guy. I mean, he was an amateur boxer before he went into the meat business, another difficult business to go into. You didn't call my dad names. You didn't mess with my dad. I mean, you know, he was as loving as can be, but you didn't want to get this guy angry. I mean, he was rocky, and she would, you know, go at him and call him names and push him and all kinds of things, which, you know, just in some ways was a sign of her poor judgment. You know, she also developed magical thinking, and there's nothing wrong with being really religious or really being magical. I mean,
magical thinking. Give us an example of magical thinking for those who don't know.
Yeah, magical thinking is thinking that the TV or the radio are communicating to you. That song that you hear on the radio is a really special song for you, that it really, you know, relates to you. And, you know, we all have that experience, and that's why certain songs hit us so hard, right, because they really speak to us in a certain way. But when you are on the cusp or in the midst of a serious mental illness, you feel that, you know, your song is the Elton John, your song or our song really is your song and only yours. And it's meant for you and it was written for you. And it now carries sort of spiritual or psychic meanings, way what is kind of beyond the, you know, usual kind of thinking. So that's an example of magical thinking. You know, we would often listen to the radio together and I would have to turn the radio off because she felt that the radio was communicating specific messages to her. And then as time went on, you know, she developed delusions, heard voices, you know, heard things that were imaginary, had a sense of her omnipotence, had a sense that she was, you know, possessed in a very, very dark and deep way. People often have the sense of other spirits in their lives, but she had it in a way that was all-consuming that prevented her from functioning. And, you know, those symptoms became worse. She developed what are manic symptoms, where she would pace back and forth frenetically, and she would speak really fast, and she would go without sleep but have more energy. that's, you know, a real, that's often a sign of the manic phase of psychosis, whether you're talking about bipolar disorder, schizoaffective disorder. So those things became more manifest, and eventually by her early 20s, she was, you know, distraught and unable to function, and never, unfortunately, made another friend for the rest of her life, and never held a job after she dropped out of college, and never had another relationship after her marriage of 1 year was annulled. Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of the downward course of both the positive symptoms of her illness, like the voices, hallucinations, you know, the magical thinking, and the negative symptoms of her illness, which is the apathy and withdrawal.
Dr. Ken Rosenberg is my guest this hour. His book, also a Sundance film selection in the documentary category, the same name, Bedlam. The book is titled Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. If you'd like to join us with an experience of yourself or a loved one touched by mental illness, severe mental illness, we're talking about mainly this hour, what was the care you experienced like? Did you find it sufficient? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Given the behavior that you just described in your sister, add to it the component of your family. You mentioned your father. You write in your book, to my working-class Jewish parents, any mental illness was a shanda, Yiddish for disgrace. Describe the way in which your family denied and covered up the increasingly alarming behavior in Merle.
Yeah, well, as soon as she went to, and first of all, that's the Yiddish term, but I think that they're, you know, I'm Jewish and very proud of it. But every religion, Judaism, Catholicism, Hinduism has their own way of covering up and fearing those with mental illness. Well, I mean, as soon as she was taken to a hospital, my older sister, Gail, who was 12 years older than me, said, Merle's sick. She needs to go to a hospital. Gail is a really brave, courageous, and super smart person, and took Merle to the hospital herself. Well, my parents thought that was really a horrendous thing to do, to take Merle into a, quote, snake pit, end quote. And I think Merle stayed there for about 2 weeks, if that, and my parents took her out against medical advice and said, you know, you all don't know what she's doing. She doesn't have this illness. You know, she'll be fine. Now, by the same token, even though that was a mistake, I have to say I understand the mistake, because I think then and still now, doctors don't often offer cures for this disease. They don't offer an easy or even accessible way out of the disease. So it's not like you go and the doctor says, here, take this pill and you'll be fine. I mean, then I think whether you deny the illness or not, whether you're ashamed of the illness or not, whether you call it a shanda, as you said in Yiddish, or not, you know, you would probably take the pill. But there is no such magic pill. There is no easy solution. So I think that part of the problem that fuels stigma is the lack of viable solutions. And I think one of the things that I argue for in the book and the film is that we need more medical research, because at the end of the day, it's about the disease and about the challenges of the diseases. That they, you know, it's, there are many factors that cause the diseases, but we need to find, you know, a better way to treat them, if not cure them. And Merle, of course, had none of that, and it progressed in a tragic way, as I write about in the book, and as I talk about in the film. It's honestly still hard to talk about. But, you know, it progressed in a very, very terrible way. She ended up jumping off her window in her bedroom onto a concrete pavement some three stories below, nearly breaking every bone in her body. She recovered from that fall, but, you know, her mental illness never recovered, and she died decades later and lived, you know, a life that was not the life that my beloved, beautiful, brilliant sister deserved to live.
You just joined us. Difficult discussions this hour, but important discussions. Dr. Ken Rosenberg, my guest, Bedlam, his book, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you for sharing that. And this book is so valuable for that very reason, that you really decided, and you said, you write about this in the book, you didn't decide to write about your family at the outset of researching this book for 7 years, but you ended up, and I think it makes it so much more effective when we hear your personal stories. There are so many personal stories. We want to get to some of those in our Iowa Public Radio audience this hour. I want to ask our listeners, because we do have a lot of interest in this discussion, to please be concise. Tell us about your situation, what happened, and we'll get some reaction to it. But there are others who will be joining in the conversation, and we do only have an hour, unfortunately. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Clinton first of all. Brian is joining us from Clinton. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hi, Doctor, I want to thank you for sharing your story. I have an 18-year-old son that's been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. He was a honor roll student up until he decided to try to start experimenting with drugs, and it's created the psychosis that he has. He has seizures and hears things and sees things. He's highly functioning, but as a father, what can I do to help him? We do have an appointment in Iowa City in November, finally, with a psychiatrist, but it took months, almost 3.5 months to get in there. We've been fighting this battle for 2 years, but I know it's a long battle that we're going to have to fight, and I just want to know what I can do as a dad, because I don't understand it. I'm not educated on this kind of stuff, and when he has these problems, it scares me.
Yeah, Brian, you are not alone, and thank you for calling in to share. Dr. Rosenberg.
Well, first of all, Brian, thank you for calling. I think your son is very, very lucky, frankly, because he has a dad who's looking for answers. And, you know, there are no easy answers, as we've been saying over and over again. But if you don't ask the question, you'll never find any answer. So I think your son is really fortunate to have you on the team. And I'm sure the feeling is mutual. One of the things you talk about is substance abuse, and substance abuse causes and opens a window on psychosis that is not really much discussed, frankly. I'm a big proponent of, you know, do whatever is healthy. If, you know, marijuana is legal, okay, you know, who am I to say you shouldn't do it? If alcohol is there, who am I to say you shouldn't drink it? But for those vulnerable people, and perhaps your son is one of them, you know, substance abuse and light drugs, hard drugs, almost doesn't matter, could really open up a window on psychosis that might otherwise have been closed. So I think that's just something to be aware of, that it sounds like his treatment is going to require sobriety, because, you know, it's hard enough when you have the propensity for schizophrenia or affective disorder. You talk about your son having schizoaffective disorder, which is a combination of bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and a certain kind of constellation of symptoms. It's hard enough to deal with that. But if you have substance abuse, man, that really makes it all the harder. So I think sobriety, easy for us to say, right? But if it's at all possible, sobriety needs to be part of his treatments. I think another wonderful resource that you could check out immediately is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. They have chapters almost everywhere. They have a great website. And from there, you'll get other, you know, options. You'll hear what other people are thinking. There's meetings, local meetings. There's national conventions. There's certainly a national conversation and a way for you to get ideas from other people. So I would say that's the other thing to do is NAMI. And I think that the third thing I just want to say is that, you know, you demonstrate, Brian, what is really, I think, the horror of dealing with serious mental illness, that, and this is one of the few illnesses where the family has to take on the burden, you know? I mean, I guess whenever anyone is sick in your family, you have to, you know, step up. But this is the one where, you know, you're the warden, the police chief, the doctor, the nurse, and you have to, you know, deal with a broken system. And I think that's, you know, one of the things I'll just say that we, all of us, really need to change. The burden on getting your son well should not fall entirely on the family. Now, it used to be 100 years ago, we used to even blame the families. You used to say it's your fault, and that was a god-awful.
I do feel it's fault.
Yeah, we used to do that. We used to call the mother schizophrenogenic. How awful is that? You have a child who has schizophrenia. You have to watch them deteriorate. You don't have any good treatments. And then you're blamed for it by the doctors, no less. So, you know, the family has always borne the brunt of this, and it's really, that's something that has to change.
Okay, Brian, thank you for calling in from Clinton. We wish you all the best helping to treat your son. And thank you so much for opening up uncovering what is a taboo still in many ways. We have to take a break in a couple minutes, Dr. Rosenberg, but we've got plenty of callers for the second half hour, but not quite enough time to take another caller. But perhaps you could address the two things that Brian expressed there. We're getting over the taboo slowly. We're talking about mental illness in the same way we talk about physical illness. We're getting there, don't you think?
Oh, I think that we're at a watershed moment. I mean, we've had some really significant laws passed. We had the 21st Century Cures Act passed a few years ago. We had the Parity Act passed with the help of Patrick Kennedy and others, and Tim Murphy, a very important person in this. We've made some really great strides, and we're beginning to have a conversation. So I think that it's actually an extremely hopeful time. My book is coming out at a good time, but I think my book probably wouldn't have been as popular 5 years ago. I don't think we were ready for the conversation. So there's much room for hope and encouragement.
Mm-hmm. Brian also mentioned there that you mentioned, and you have so much history, we will likely not get into much, if any of it, the milestones in the history of treating mental illness that are just such sort of tragic, bizarre treatments that were developed and practiced throughout history. But Brian mentioned that, you know, and you mentioned families were blamed. Brian, in the 21st century, 2019, blames himself. We heard him say that. I mean, what do you say to families of patients who blame themselves? And you have to, you know, replay endlessly. What if I had done this differently when he was 5 years old or 10 years old?
Being a parent is the greatest thing that ever happened to me, but I also know it can sometimes be a thankless task. You only look at the mistakes and you only get the demerits. You don't get the credits necessarily. So, of course, when something's wrong with your child, you blame yourself. That just automatically happens no matter what it is. You know, if your child, God forbid, develops diabetes, you say, maybe I had them on the wrong diet. And certainly if they develop mental illness, you say, you know, what do I do? It's more complicated with mental disorders because often the person who has mental disorder is not so easy to live with.
Okay.
You may say things and do things which you later feel guilty about, but in a word, I could say, it's not your fault. You didn't cause this, and you can't cure it, but you can help it.
Dr. Ken Rosenberg is with us. He'll be with us in the second half hour. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Plenty of callers willing to join in. That's wonderful. Let me give out the NAMI telephone number, 800-950-6264. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour with Dr. Ken Rosenberg, psychiatrist practicing in Manhattan, also a distinguished fellow in the American Psychiatric Association. He's also a Peabody Award-winning documentary filmmaker. Bedlam is the title of the film, also the title of the book we're talking about this hour, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. In the course of writing this book, Dr. Rosenberg spoke with hundreds of people about serious mental illness, schizophrenia, severe depression, bipolar disorder, he spoke with family members as well as experts in the field. Let's listen to a short clip from the film Bedlam, which is was at the 2019 Sundance Film Festival. This is Todd from the film.
A lot of people down here suffer from either drug addiction or mental health issues, and that's why they're down here. It's sad. It's really sad. You know, I suffer from it, and these people suffer from it, and there ain't no help nowhere. We just keep going around in circles, and we get nothing. It's just sad.
Dr. Rosenberg, tell us a little more about Todd.
Oh, Todd is one of the many people who are in this film, which will be broadcast on PBS's Independent Lens in April. He is a man who is homeless, has serious mental illness. And we follow Todd, like everyone else in this book and film, for many, many years, at least 5 years. And
followed Todd when he was in the came to the USC, LAC, the busiest emergency room in the country in Los Angeles, and then followed Todd as he went out into the streets after his hospitalization and how he struggled to find a house. And he finds that house, he finds that home with the help of some really great people, an organization called LAMP in Los Angeles. But then ultimately things don't go his way because of many factors, including the criminal justice system. That's Todd's story in a few words, but I think that really what Todd demonstrates is that this really brave, kind soul is a throwaway person in America. He's the kind of person that we don't have anything to do with, and he suffers, and his illness doesn't get better. And that's no fault of a doctor or a nurse. He has some dedicated health professionals who are really trying to find him help. But there isn't kind of a place that he fits into. There isn't a housing situation which is really, works for him. He also is plagued with a mental illness, which is not adequately treated, and substance abuse, which, often runs the show for anyone who is mentally ill in particular, but anyone who is the victim of substance abuse. So Todd is like so many people. He's like 20,000 people with serious mental illness who sleep on the streets of Los Angeles every night, like 350,000 Americans, homeless Americans, who sleep on the streets every night with serious mental illness. His story is compelling, tragic, but he's one of hundreds of thousands.
Dr. Ken Rosenberg with us, if you've just joined us. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Charlotte, who's been waiting in Charles City. We have Dr. Rosenberg, so many people wanting to share their personal stories. We will get through as many as possible. Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to tell you about my grandson. He was a bright, outgoing young man with a job and a girlfriend and just doing well in life, and he suddenly began having visions and hearing voices. He got progressively worse until March of 2017, I believe it was. His mother and sister, who were close to him, had convinced him to go to the ER at the local hospital. At that time, once he got there, he became belligerent and did not want to be admitted, but they admitted him to the mental health ward. They only kept him after 2 days, they diagnosed him with what they said was a thought disorder, sent him home with medication. So it took it was a 3-day thing. He came home to our house where his grandparents, and he stayed with us. He developed a severe, very, very severe allergic reaction to one of the medications. He had an angry rash all over his body and his face, his hands and feet swelled. His mother desperately tried to contact the doctors who had prescribed this medication, and no one would respond to her. For 24 hours, she kept trying to contact people to help. Finally, she got a doctor who hadn't treated him, who just said, quit taking the medicine, give him Benadryl. So that's what we did. However, then his condition was going totally untreated. He got progressively worse, and because of his experience, refused to go back to the emergency room. And 5 months later, he committed suicide.
Oh, Charlotte.
He was only 22.
I am so sorry. That's awful. Charlotte, thank you for sharing a very painful chapter in your family. Dr. Rosenberg, what can we say to that?
Well, first of all, everyone's heart goes out to you, Charlotte, and I'm so sorry for your loss, truly. This is exactly what we need to change. We need to prevent more, and so kind of you to not only, to share it with everyone, painful as it is. As I said earlier, it's painful for me to talk about my sister to this very day, but I think we have to tell our stories to prevent other tragedies. And unfortunately, there's elements that are so common in the tragic story of your wonderful grandson. One is that he goes to the ER and it becomes an unwelcome place. Two is that he goes to get help, medical help, and the doctors and nurses really just don't know how to help him. I mean, they provide him with this or that, but 2 days of treatment,
That's not enough. He needed 2 months of treatment, maybe 2 years of treatment, but not 2 days. That has a lot to do with the legal standard of how long people are involuntarily committed in hospital easily. That's the standard is 2 or 3 days. It has a lot to do with what insurance pays for and doesn't pay for, that they'll pay for a few days, but say, you know, this person can be treated on an outpatient basis. It has a lot to do with the lack of empathy and understanding about serious mental illness. And, you know, that doesn't happen in other diseases. We don't let people with cardiac disease, we don't let people with heart attacks leave the hospital within 2 days or 2 hours, as we do with, and we surely don't put them in jail as we do with people with serious mental illness. And we treat them with an enormous degree of hospitality and kindness. And I understand people with serious mental illness could be belligerent and antagonistic, and that doesn't incur kindness, but that's because their brains are not working. It's not that different from dementia or a stroke. When someone has a stroke or a heart attack and, God forbid, drives into a tree, you don't blame them. You don't commit and say they've committed murder. You say that, you know, they had a medical condition which precluded them from getting well. It's not a way to pardon people who do bad things, but it's a way to understand them. And clearly, Charlotte, in the tragic story that you relay, there was not a lack of understanding, and the system was broken, and you and your family have suffered as a consequence.
Charlotte from Charles City, again, thanks for calling. As the doctor says, telling stories, painful stories, to prevent, possibly prevent other tragedies. That's what this hour is with Dr. Ken Rosenberg. Bedlam, the title of his book, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. He spent seven years, looking into the lives, talking with Americans with serious mental illness, talking with their families, with medical experts. He also writes about the struggles with having a sister who suffered from schizophrenia. Go back to the phones. Our hour quickly disappearing. Unfortunately, Kristen is with us in North Liberty. I'll have to ask you to be concise, Kristen, but thank you so much. Please share your experience.
I'm calling on behalf of my 9-year-old daughter. She is beautiful and beyond intelligent. We started working with her when she was 2.5, and if you know about children, you know diagnoses are fluid. Last winter, we ended up being 17 days inpatient at the University of Iowa, and I'm a voice for her. So the mm-hmm. heartbreaking thing for her is she calls it the dungeon. We have a beautiful new children's hospital, and unfortunately, the children's hospital has only 15 beds in the old part of the hospital for ages 3 to 17 on the same unit. And so I had to leave my child with teenagers that were much larger than herself. And because it's recreation services and not child life involved with the children, my daughter missed out on a lot of therapy and care she could have gotten. It's been a process for us just to care for her and love her and accept her as she is. And so I'm always trying to be such an advocate for her because she looks normal. So my battle this year has been with new staff at the school and telling them, no, she's not oppositional defiant. She's got obsessive compulsive disorder and nonverbal learning disability. And her brain is operating on a whole different scale. So being a parent, it's advocating for your child, but it's also the fact that in Iowa, there's only 31 child psychiatrists in 3 counties. And fortunately, we're in a county that has child psychiatrists, but we also have a very antiquated and broken mental health unit for our children in the area. And so just putting my story out there about her and about the system in Iowa being very broken. My dad had retired in New Mexico, so we started off in New Mexico where they were refusing to mainstream her. So we came home to Iowa, and we had the choice between 50th in the nation for mental health care or 50th in the nation for education. And because she's so intelligent, I picked 50th in the nation for mental health care.
Kristen, Thank you. We wish you the best there in North Liberty. We won't be able to go on at length about your case here. We'll have the doctor react to it. But there's so many themes, Dr. Rosenberg, that you have in your book. The lack of inpatient beds, the lack of resources, the right. number of psychiatrists we have around the country. What she's describing here in Iowa is throughout the nation, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. So in Los Angeles, where we base our work, I mean, I live in New York City, but I went to Los Angeles because Los Angeles is the epicenter of the crisis. For the entire county of Los Angeles, uninsured beds for children or adolescents, the number is 10. Oh. When we were there. So it's even worse than in Iowa. Now there's good people there trying to change it. And any system is complicated to change. But yes, I was there documenting the crisis, and one night when there were 12 children waiting in the emergency room and 10 beds in the entire county, and all those beds were filled, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So the situation is dire, and that's why it's so great that Kristen is speaking up. And by the way, I just want to say to Kristen, she offers something that's so wonderful and so invaluable, which is that unconditional love. Again, I think, you know, we talked earlier about how parents of people with children and adults with serious mental illness are often blamed, but they're actually the heroes of this. I mean, Kristen's unconditional love will do much more than any doctor or nurse can do. But the system is broken, and we do have to tell these stories to remedy it in some significant way. Again, this does not happen for cancer or cardiac disease, or HIV.
Mm. We have less than 10 minutes left, Dr. Rosenberg, and we have other callers. Perhaps we'll get to another caller or two here, but I wanted to make sure we got into the part of the conversation, the part of the book that where you address the policy changes that you encourage people to fight for, to contact lawmakers about, to really talk to their friends and neighbors about, so that this can be raised out of the what is a dismal abyss for many people in finding mental health care service.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the first and foremost thing is we need to talk about it. We need to not only declare the problem, but we need to march for the problem. You know, just as I was waiting for this call, I went downstairs to get a cup of tea. And I saw a wonderful postcard with a pink ribbon on it. And as you can imagine, that's pink ribbon for breast cancer. And because of those pink ribbons and because of those advocates and because of the people marching in the street, breast cancer, still a difficult disease, is not the disease it was 100 years ago. We'd like to see that happen with mental illness. We'd like to see Big Pharma not completely pull out of neuropsych. A long conversation, but suffice to say that the medicines that we use in psychiatry are effective, but they're roughly 70 years old. And there are some new medicines, but they're not really new. They're kind of updated versions of the old medicines. Again, we don't see that in cancer and cardiac disease. The medicines there are just a couple of years old. So that's one of the things we'd like to see. In terms of the policy, we'd also like to see more beds and more community mental health treatments. So we have roughly, because of deinstitutionalization, the collapse of the asylums, which were dreadful, we now have 2 or 3% of the beds per capita that we had in 1950. That's a terrible thing. Mental illness has not gone away, but the beds have. So we need to see research, we need to see beds, we need to see community outreach treatments. President Kennedy had a very good idea. He wanted to see community treatments, and that was intrinsically a good idea. Now, I have to say it wasn't executed, you know, perfectly. And part of the problem in the execution is that those community mental health centers did not deal with the sickest people. They wanted to prevent new cases, but they weren't really prepared for the people coming out of the asylums. So we need kind of new community treatments, and there are very good models around the country. There's actually good models in Europe that were, you know, what we write about in the book. So there are ways to do this. And there are specific policy changes, again, we like to see. We talked about the parity bill that was enacted in 2010, which means that if you have a mental illness, you should get care and coverage from your insurance carrier on par with a medical illness. That's parity. Parity for the mental conditions as on par with the medical conditions. Well, that hasn't been realized, but it's in law, so you could actually now sue the insurance companies as
we are effectively doing and saying, you know what, this is a law. You all have to kind of put up or shut up and change your ways. We have something called an IMD exclusion, which means that if you have a hospital with 16 beds, and if it has over 16 beds for psychiatry, the feds, Medicaid, will not pay for that. That makes no sense, because in Twin Towers, where I document this problem, in a jail, we have 1,500 beds for people with serious mental illness. So these are one of the policy changes we need to see, the repeal of the IMD Exclusion Act.
Okay, so much more in this book, Dr. Ken Rosenberg, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. Let's go back to our phones quickly. Our time is running out. Martha, in Washington County here in Iowa, thank you so much. Don't have much time for you, but we sure appreciate you joining our conversation.
Hi, I'll try to be brief. Let's see, I have suffered from some mental health diagnoses, and I'm chemically dependent, and that runs in my family. I've been completely clean and sober for 31 years. I'm 68 years old. Anyway, my brother, who is 3 years older than I was and had been diagnosed with severe severe chemical dependency and schizophrenia. He was in and out of the psych hospitals and tied his sheets together to escape and all kinds of stuff. But anyway, he died at age 57, a really horrible death from esophageal varices, and was found like a day and a half later. It was not pretty, I understand. Anyway, I have been of the opinion, and I want to check out whether it's correct. I've been of the opinion that a person who suffers from chemical dependency and mental health issues, that it's difficult to get an accurate diagnosis until the person is sober for a good length of time. And I'm wondering if that is true.
Martha in Washington.
100% correct. 100%. And you know, so sorry to hear about your brother, and also so grateful to hear about your sobriety of 31 years. I know that has not been easily earned, so congratulations on your sobriety. You're absolutely correct that if you have an addiction problem, an abuse problem, that it's not impossible, but near impossible to properly diagnose depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, because your brain is now under the influence of a completely exogenous substance, and until you get rid of that substance, you don't know what lies beneath. And as you know from your experience of being sober, it takes about a year for the brain to clear to know what's really going on. So that's why the first and foremost rule for people who have serious mental illness or have any mental illness, any, you know, it doesn't have to be so serious, it could be anxiety, depression, is to really try to be sober. I know that is a lot to ask sometimes, but it will really help clarify what is the problem and what isn't the problem.
Okay, before we go, we have about a minute left. I want to give out the NAMI contact information again and then ask you, Dr. Rosenberg, for some hopeful words on the way out of this hour to contact the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Their hotline is 800-950-6264, 800-950-6264. They can handle any sort of mental illness, mental health question. If you'd like to check them out online, NAMI.org, NAMI.org. The final few seconds to you, Dr. Rosenberg.
The hope is that we're having this conversation. This is not a conversation that is had often. When we showed our film on Sundance, and we'll show our film on PBS in April on Independent Lens, it will be a rarity. That shouldn't be. We are now having a national conversation that has not been had, and I think that's very, very important. I'll also say one thing about the treatments. The treatments are imperfect, but if we had not a new drug, not a new psychotherapy, not a new intervention, but people just use the treatments they have, because less than 50% of the folks get those treatments, if people use the treatments they had, we would save hundreds and thousands of lives.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll have to leave it there. Dr. Ken Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Ken Rosenberg, the author of Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. Also, as he mentioned, a film. He is a producer and director. It played at the U.S. Documentary Competition in the 2019 Sundance Film Festival. Bedlam coming to PBS, but also perhaps there are other ways to watch it as well. So look for that. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Matt Alvarez. Also thanks to Julia DiGiacomo. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.